I protected people from my grief. Mm. And I did a lot of what I call my kitchen floor parties when I would just lie down on the floor. It was about sinking. It was about not existing, being as low as I could. And I just think, you can't see this. This is too raw for you. Mm. And I have to present a version which is photoshopped a little bit. Mm. And now I don't care.
Welcome to Grief Encounters with me, Sasha Hamrogue.
And I'm Venetia Quick. We're a weekly podcast that looks at an issue that affects us all and yet remains so difficult to talk about.
We'll be chatting to guests from all walks of life on the subject of death and all that comes with it.
Our main aim is to motivate, comfort and create a modern space for people to share their own experiences.
Could you think of someone that could benefit in listening? Tell them about Grief Encounters, out every single Tuesday. On this week's episode of Grief Encounters, we spoke with the really beautiful, charismatic, amazing Emily Dean.
Yeah.
We spoke to her in London. This was one of the episodes that we recorded in London, which was a great day. And we got to talk to so many interesting people. But Emily, I think both of us, after we talked to her, were like, oh my God, we just want to be around her all the time. She's such an amazing person. She lost her sister, Rachel, to cancer. And it's so obvious in how she speaks about her, how important her sister was to her and how vivid she still is.
Yeah.
And she also lost her parents in quick succession. Emily wrote a book called Everybody Died, So I Got a Dog, and I've been reading it, and it's brilliant. Wasn't it such a great chat?
Yeah, it was. I mean, I think it's interesting because she also, and possibly for the first time we spoke about her sister Rachel had a daughter and her relationship with her and how that changes when you go from being auntie to sort of second mom. Mm. And I thought that was sort of interesting because it happens in so many situations where obviously Emily is this cool sort of journo woman about town. I mean, she came in with her little dog and, you know, looked really good. She'd been at some breakfast when we'd, you know, and she just like sort of floated into the room and she has a huge presence.
Presence, yeah.
Which I think comes across a lot. But also she's one of those people who masks, I think, you know, maybe what's going on inside. Mm. And one of those people that you'd sort of go, oh, isn't she doing great? Or she's doing amazingly. Sort of only somebody in our situation knows that half the time she probably goes home, closes the door and bursts into tears.
And she talks about that a little bit. I think her power is in her words. I think when she starts speaking, obviously she works in radio and she's a writer, but her power is in her words because once they start to come out and she speaks about grief, she does so in such an eloquent and interesting. And again, she is funny.
Very funny.
There's a term she uses for us that's like we're kind of like the death squad.
Yeah.
You guys can check it out.
Today's guest, Emily Dean, is a writer for The Times. She hosts the incredibly entertaining Walking the Dog podcast. She co-presents the Frank Skinner Show on Absolute Radio and also has somehow found time to write her own memoir, Everybody Died, So I Got a Dog. Loss has unfortunately played a large part in your life over the last number of years. I'd love to start if you could tell us a little bit about your sister, Rachel.
Yeah. Hi, by the way. It's so nice to be here with you girls. Is it okay to still say girls?
Yeah,
I'm happy.
Yeah.
I like gals as well.
Yeah.
And we have Raymond, the dog here.
Yes, we do. We're not,
he's
it's
very
not just
cute.
Girls. Very, very
the girls
cute dog.
And Raymond.
He likes women.
Yes.
Yeah. He likes a village of women. Yeah, so my sister, Rachel, I wrote this book essentially about the loss of my sister and both my parents and... As I describe in this, it was the speed and the swiftness of it. Mm. And I know you both have experienced loss, but there's no better way, as we know. There's no better or worse. But for me, I compared it to the Game of Thrones episode, like the Red Wedding. Yeah. Everyone was gone, you know, and that's a different kind of loss to process. Mm. And with my sister, it's, again, a loss which I know you've experienced, which is the sense of a life interrupted and the sense of her being... 43, she just had her second child who was just about to turn one. Mm. And it was all really significant to me that my sister sort of hung on for her first birthday. And I don't have children. And I remember my mother saying to me, I said, look, she's about to have chemotherapy. She got very sick very quickly. It was literally we were trying on clothes in Topshop one day and she was saying, I can't shift this baby weight. Mm. And it turned out it was actually a swollen abdomen from the cancer.
Wow.
So sorry to start with such technical stuff so early on and to keep it on a downer, but that, you know, I suppose, why am I apologising for that? We have to be honest about these things, and I don't have to say that.
But
in
it
front
also
of
creates awareness, I think, as well, that sometimes we sort of go, oh, yeah, that's because of that, or I have a headache because I had a drink yesterday or whatever. But actually, sometimes it without scaremongering people, it can be much more.
And that's how a lot important. Of times, that's how the story starts. It's you're in Topshop the most. You know, such, when you said that, it's like such a sister thing to be doing.
Yeah. And we used to do this sort of clothes rap battle thing. So we'd be trying things on and she'd say, oh, no, you look a bit like, you know, you're an ex-raver who owns a stall in Camden Market. And it was a fun thing that we would do. And I remember so vividly, someone said to me recently, how did you remember everything with... slightly accusatory tone. I was like, you're suggesting I made it up. No, they weren't. But I think it was so interesting that I thought, when you've experienced these sort of things, the vividness, I will never forget those things that were said at that moment. And so, yeah, that stuck in my mind, that incident in Topshop. So she then got sick very quickly. And within, I guess, 3.5 weeks of her diagnosis, she died. Yeah.
Oh, God.
Wow. It was pretty awful. So she was diagnosed it was sort of just after Christmas, just before New Year, and she died the 21st of Jan. So there was no ramp, and that was strange.
I don't even know if you can answer this question, but was she in any way able to process what was happening in that short a period of time?
Well, do you know, that's a good question, because I think for her, and she and I were very close, I should say, because we grew up in this... I mean, it's a sort of family I've come to love, really, now, which is not much use because they're not here anymore. But I do...
But it's comforting, though.
It is comforting, you know, because I have lovely memories of them. And I think my family were sort of a circus, I compared it to. My parents were performers, my mum was an actor, and my dad was a BBC arts reporter in the 60s, and so when he started. But it was a peripatetic, slightly unstable childhood, and... lots of bohemian artists who are great fun to be around, but if you want fish fingers on the table at you know, 5 p.m., they're not your people.
Yeah.
You know, if you want canapés for breakfast and
great
philosophers talking through the night.
Yeah.
But yeah, so my sister was I called her my lighthouse. She was home.
Mm.
And so the loss represented a lot to me, but I think I was also just really conscious that she'd done... all those, she'd hit her beats. She had the Farrah and Ball door and the husband and the puppy called Giggle and the two kids. And I was this woman with parking tickets and stilettos in her car. And it should have been me. You know, I really felt survivor's guilt, I think, over that. But I think with her, sorry to answer your question about her processing it, it was so quick. And I remember she said she didn't want to talk about going. And I was very conscious with her youngest daughter, Bertie, who was only... one, she was sort of handing her over to me quite a bit, and that was sort of heartbreaking because I thought, oh my God, is that a real act of selflessness as a mother that you're sort of thinking this is who's going to be in your life now? And I don't, but she only mentioned it a few times. She said to me once about Mimi, her daughter, who was then 10 at the time, she just said it very sort of to cast it aside, you know, tossed it aside and said, oh, can you take her to buy a bra? And it was so strange. And I said, yeah, of course. And she said, and talk to her about periods and things because men are rubbish at that. Anyway, and then she went on to the next thing and I thought, God, that sounds silly, but a conversation like that was so huge to me, you know. So, yeah.
Did that make or
so
has...
I'm laughing in a bad way. No. I've got you crying already.
I'm sorry.
I'm just wondering, by doing that, does that make it easier for you? I mean, obviously you're involved with the kids.
Yeah.
Does that make it slightly easier that your sister lives on through them, or does it make it more difficult to see? Because we were having a conversation actually just an hour or two ago
on
the airplane about my youngest son. It couldn't be more like my husband in personality and temperament and just the way he carries on. And sometimes I find that really sad. And sometimes I just go, well, Martin lives on. And this is great because Casper is Martin and he goes on. But then sometimes I find that really hard. And it's that balance.
And
it's
your husband was kind of a similar age, wasn't he?
He was 49.
To my sister. So it's, I think, I think that's a really good question, actually, because I know that some of my sister's friends, and I don't know if you experienced this when you lost Martin, but some of my sister's friends struggled a bit, I think, with even spending time with me.
Yeah.
And one of them said, it's very weird when I speak to you because you sound like her. And I think with the girls, what's tough is they represent loss. They represent her absence. My niece, Mimi, like you were saying about Casper, is the spitting image of my sister. And you know what's weird? Sometimes friends will say, oh my God, her eyebrows. It's really strange little details like that. But, you know, my sister used to have a thing. We used to say, great brows, ma'am, because someone once said that to her in New York. And it was, you know, this scent sprayer? It was this really camp scent sprayer. And he came up to her and squirted her with Marc Jacobs.
Such a New York
yeah. And it was the fact that he came up and he squirted her with Marc Jacobs. I never forgot him. Great brows, ma'am.
Yeah.
And we said it all the time.
Have a nice day.
Yeah, it was. And it was like, yeah. Rach said, yeah, I mean, she said, I loved him because I could tell he was gay because, yeah. you know, it was no yeah. straight man. Would have yeah. noticed him. Like, not great yeah. rag, great yeah. brows. But you know what? I say that to Mimi now. And there's a continuity. Mm. So I suppose I love that. I will tell her stuff about my sister. And I think she yeah. is my sister. And actually, it is a process, as we all know. And it's tough sometimes, but it's kind of beautiful. And I love that. And I hope you feel that with your kids, that it's that's my sister. That's her essence. That's who she is. And, you know, that's you. People always say with loss, don't they, that you never forget the person because the loss becomes part of you and you fold it into yourself and you change.
Oh, you change.
And your children change. Yeah. You know, the different people.
Without doubt. Without doubt.
I think the term is secondary losses, although I'm not really sure what the right terminology is. Mm. But if you've lost someone and then you in quick succession you lose someone else, and like you said, I think that is a very strange territory in terms of how the grief processes, especially if it's a short period of time, because yeah. you've hardly gotten through one thing, or you might be starting to come to terms, or whatever the right way to say it would be, and then something else happens, and it compounds it, and it's such a bigger thing. I mean, how long was it between losing your sister that you lost your
and
parents?
My parents? Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. I call it whack-a-mole because you're sort of, you know, it's that fairground game where you're thinking, oh, I'm just dealing with that. Oh no, another thing's yeah, popping up, and it's impossible to sort of keep tabs on all those emotions that. And I so after my sister died. And another thing that I didn't realise was I thought it was like movies where we'd all cry and everyone would be very, there'd be all this warmth and there'd be no complications. And of course,
it's a hard thing to navigate.
We all know it's not like that. And it brings up strange things. Families' dynamics get destroyed. And it's like a rock being lifted up and suddenly everyone's role has changed. And I don't know if that's something you guys experienced.
We actually literally talked about that as well on the plane, the whole, I think, I mean, like, I've experienced people who just can't be in the house, mainly male friends, because they just, you know, it's just they're in, out, just can't. Other people sort of just don't want to talk about it. Other people
really
want to talk about it all the time. You know, and I just think people, and one thing we've discovered with this podcast is everybody grieves so totally differently.
Yeah.
And whereas I was initially would get angry with somebody not grieving the way I thought they should be grieving, now I realise that you've got to let people grieve the way they grieve and that's how they do it, and not just because you're the person who's lost someone, because they have too.
Yeah, yes, exactly. And you know, do... Sorry, were you going to say something?
No, I was just going to say, I think that what you said is so true. Like, I was completely in the same boat where I thought it was going to be about crying. I thought it was going to be about sadness. I thought maybe it would be about depression. But I didn't think it was going to be about anger and family rifts and battles about things you didn't even understand and drawing lines in the set. And like all of those things just shocked me that was part of it, because it felt like things are already so hard. Why are we engaging in this? But actually now I see it so much as part of grief, that everyone is struggling, and that's a natural part of that struggle.
Do you think also it's outrage in a way, and fear and confusion at being confronted with that mortality? So it's a need to impose control, isn't it? Because you've lost, it's the ultimate loss of control, is losing someone you love very much. And so I think when me and my mother were arguing about whether to use the King James version of Corinthians or, you know, and literally screaming at each other in the funeral directors, or why have you put, no, Rach hated red roses, they're disgusting. She thought that. So you know, my father, actually, when he was around, was a very intelligent man and was capable of some brilliant insights. And he always said, rows are never what they're about.
No, it's so true. Yeah.
And I sort of, you know, it's true. We all know that's true. So, sorry, to get back to what you were saying earlier, I lost my sister and she died, as I said, very swiftly. So within this kind of, you know, shockingly swift time frame of like 3 weeks or something, she got sick end of December and then she was dead by the end of January. And then my mum, who was a very, she had been an actor and she was a drama teacher as well. And she was that person at the party who was there when the lights were, you know, dancing to Don't Stop Me Now with a, you know, glass of champagne.
I love her.
Yeah, she's me.
She was brilliant, yeah. And she would say, I hate sitting with the oldies. And my sister would say, you know, you're 70s.
Yeah, yeah.
But she was a character, you know. And so to see the decline in her was quite shocking. And suddenly, so she got motor neurone disease, it was a year or 10 months after Rach died. And then she died a year after that. So, and then my dad died only 6 months later after my mum. So it was within 3 years they'd all died. And actually I was estranged from my dad, which is complicated and was complicated. And I had a moment with him on the deathbed where he looked up and he looked at me and our eyes just met. And it was really weird. I'll never forget that moment. And I compare it to him saying, oh, you came. I'm glad you came.
Mm.
And it's not the movies where you say, I'm sorry, Daddy.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
Didn't happen.
Yeah.
But just that look, we didn't need to say anymore. Yeah. It was kind of, okay, you came, we're okay. And actually just from that moment, I think, but, you know, also I would say to people who haven't been present, because I had someone I know recently who wasn't present when they lost a sibling, and I really wanted to reassure them, it doesn't make any difference. Listen, if you're there, you'll say to yourself, I didn't say the right thing. And
yeah, I mean, my last text to Martin was dishwasher. Do you know what I mean? And then, like, he died and I always sort of go, oh, I should have just double-checked he was okay. Do you know what I mean? Mm. So you always have that. Or if somebody, I don't know, if you lose somebody suddenly in a motor accident or something, that there's so many times you don't get to say goodbye anyway. So I think that's something you have to work through in your own head. Yeah. And that only takes time.
And did he die? He died
at home. Yeah, yeah, suddenly.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think one of the things that surprised me, what you mentioned about TV, like that, you know, you'd be holding a bed.
Yeah.
We imagine death to be holding someone's hand and that they exchange these words of wisdom, possibly. And with parents, I definitely, with my dad, I was like, I wanted to learn as much in those last few days. Like, what can he, is there anything he's going to say to me or I need to say to him? And it was so the opposite of that.
Really?
It wasn't anything like that. I mean, he was kind of like, can you please get my laptop going so I can do work? He was consumed by wanting to do his job.
Yeah.
Then he wanted to watch rugby and football. Then I asked him for relationship advice and he said, oh, honey, I haven't a clue. Like, and I just thought he'd say like something brilliant. And then the last words he said to me were, and this is something that's hard to say, but the reality, he was on morphine and they didn't make any sense. And they still don't make any sense because they were just, you know. But I was there when he died. And then when my mom died, I'd been by her bedside like every minute of every day. And I stepped out to get lunch and she died.
And then
in
she
the
lost
time.
It. Yeah.
It is a thing that people feel like there will be time or it almost feels like it's never going to be what you
expect.
Well,
it doesn't always go according to plan either.
No.
Do you know what I mean? Like, I mean, with Martin, he wasn't supposed to, like, he had cancer. And we'd only talked about the night before what would happen in the 18 months that we expected he'd have. Do you know what I mean? There was no plan that I was going to walk out the door and he was going to go. So it's sort of like, I think that's probably maybe also one of the shocks when somebody really close to you dies, and especially if they have been sick, because you have this great plan in your head about how they're going to go and you're going to go, like, totally in love and... It doesn't always work out like that. It's
well, you're so right, because you get that sense, and I did, of obviously with partners and parents and siblings, this is the thing about close familial relationships. It's sort of different to friends, because we do, to a degree, we PR ourselves with friends. They don't see, sorry, my headphones fell off just at a really poignant moment. They don't see, I suppose, the ugliness and the pain in quite the same way that people
are behind closed
doors.
Yeah.
And I think I was conscious with my sister of thinking every single, you know, I had this Arya Stark list in my head of all the things I'd done to her. You know, when I stole her Walkman in 1986 and I lied and then she found it in my bag. And it was all these things. And I just wanted to make it up to her. I thought, if I can just have enough time to be good. And of course I didn't. And so I had exactly what you've described of sitting there in this intensive care unit thinking, what do I do? No one told me what to do. Do I make a speech like the movies? But then actually, you know what struck me? I don't want her to know that she's dying. I want her to feel that she's going to sleep. So I just sort of made this decision that it was her ending, not mine. It wasn't my right to impose closure on that moment. So I just chatted to her. But, you know, and we did sort of, me and my mother and my brother-in-law had a sort of house style going, which was gentle, and we'd talk, and occasionally we'd say things like, I'd laugh at my mother's clothes, and then my sister would open her eyes and have this mischievous look, because that was what we did. And that was one of our final things, which I love because it was so us, is I said, well, you know, I mean, the real tragedy is Mum's outfit today. It was, she opened her, she just looked at me as if to say, good, we're still the same people.
And it's good to say about humour, because we're just laughing there about something, and it sort of brought me back to the actual the week Martin died, and there were two of our friends who just came out with these same buzzwords all the way through, that just every time one of them came out with it, it was just like me and my best friend would have a giggle, or when the Undertaker came round and called me the wrong name all the way through.
Sorry, I love things.
But it was like, oh, it was all the way through for like 2 hours playing thing. I'm very sorry for loss. Venetia, Venetia, Venetia. And it was actually my mother-in-law had used to call me that, so it was incredibly funny, and Martin would have found it terribly funny. And I was just thinking about, you know, the way you're laughing there about your mum's outfit and how important humour is to get you. Like, and some people just don't understand it. They sort of go, oh, she's laughing, she must be grand.
Yeah.
But it's like, I think it sort of gets you, you need it to get you through.
I think you do. And also that particular kind of gallows humour, which is, you know, there was the priest said at my, when my mum died, I think, so hard to remember, I've got so many. But when my mum died, and in fact, when Frank Skinner, my colleague, interviewed me recently, he was talking about it, and he said, I'm sorry, but that priest came out, it was a great gag. And he said at my mum's funeral, he opened with, I do keep telling Emily, we must stop meeting like this. And what was weird was I laughed, but I noticed the people in the crowd, there was a sort of, is this okay to laugh at this? Cause, but I liked it. I liked it when, you know, my sister, who was sort of, I guess, spiritual rather than conventionally and formally religious, but she had that, you know, she wanted to see a priest. And when she was at the hospital and she'd first got the diagnosis, she'd seen a priest. And he was what I call our sort of priest. He was very sort of quite, he was good if you weren't sort of religious. So he was talking about spirituality and family. I don't know that much about religion, so I didn't realise there's a whole other type of priest. And being from Ireland, you'll be more familiar with this, presumably, which is a terrible generalisation for me. But he turned up with a bloody silk stole and cat. And I was like, oh, no, this is like the omen.
And the wrong funeral.
Honestly, as he turned up, I could tell. I thought, oh, I've made a terrible booking. I've booked the wrong guy for the gig. And he starts reading from the Bible in this solemn tone. And my mum was great, because, again, she dismantled it after he left. She said, well, she was a bit fire and brimstone, dear. Like he was a drag queen or something. I was like, but those things you remember. Mm.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're looking for a safe haven to express how you feel, share articles, photos, and memories of your loved ones, join the Grief Encounters Facebook group, a place for support, compassion and empathy for those grieving.
This humor brings me back to the title of your book.
Yes.
Which, long before you were ever going to be a guest on our podcast, and I'm very glad you are, when I saw the title of the book, like, immediately hit home for me, because my sister and I, that's how we deal with it. So everybody died, right? So we're like, well, before everybody died, it was like this, and then everybody died and now it's like this. And there's kind of this two worlds.
Yes, yes.
Before everybody died and after everybody died. And there's a disconnect from your original family. Like, do you struggle with being alone in trying to your memories and connecting to them? And how do you... Like, I have certain friends who are very good at bringing my parents. They'll say, they'll take me back to something, and they do it on purpose. Like, you can tell that they make sure to mention them and memories, yes, maybe that aren't memories that aren't at the top of my mind. Do you feel that does that help sometimes to have those type of people? Or do you feel that disconnect between the past and the present?
And the present. Well, you're right. I always say it feels like my witnesses have gone, my fellow witnesses to everything that we had. And there's something about your... you know, the family you grow up with, in whatever form that takes, that it defines you. It's who you are. And I will sometimes, I had moments when I would go to ring my sister about something funny, or I'd pass somewhere or something funny would happen, and I would go to pick up the phone, and this sinking feeling of, I've got no one to tell. No one understands this. So I definitely felt losing all of them. That was tough. Just that sense of... you know, I was the last one at the party. The lights had come on. They'd all got cabs. And, you know, I couldn't get one home, and I was stuck there on my own. So what's really helpful for me is friends. I have my best friend, Jane Goldman, who's been my childhood best friend. And so she knew Rach. She knew my family. She'll say, do you remember when we did this? Do you remember that? And I love that. You know, she's still got videos that she made of when we were like 12 doing play. And that feels like home. And also I love it. I talk to Frank a lot about stuff my parents said and did. And I guess that's important. And also weirdly, writing the book, that feels like I've sort of kept their memory alive.
Oh, yeah.
Oddly, it feels like...
But I think the more you talk, or once... I think also once it's in print.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
their name is in print. I sort of found that with Martin afterwards, because we did a big gig and everything for him, and I, sort of all the newspaper articles and everything about him. And once I saw his photo in the paper again with his name there, it was like, oh, he's still sort of, he's still there. Still sort of,
well, his legacy's there.
Yeah.
You know, and that's like with your parents, I'm sure, as well. It's that thing of, I think what surprised me so much about loss is how someone's loss becomes a legacy if you want it to, you know, and it's hard. And obviously the first 2 years, forget it. You know, all that. You're not going to do any alchemy in the first two. There's no time limit. We know it might take you 5 years, 10 years. But there does come a point, or there did for me at least, when I thought, right, how can I make sense of this? How can I make sense of this? And actually it was turning the loss of those people, I suppose folding them into me. And then that becomes, they're part of me. So now... I feel with the book, I'd never have done that if they hadn't have died. And that for me, I mean, it sounds terrible when you talk about this, because it's like, well, you know, because they died, I was able to write a book. But it's more that actually, you know, it's whether you're going to turn that loss into...
something positive.
Yeah, I think so.
And oftentimes loss can kind of really hold you to task as to who you are and the stuff you're made of, right? So you can work on yourself and you can then... develop abilities to do things you didn't ever expect. I remember, I've said this on the podcast once before, but a therapist that I went to after my mom died said there's a richness in this, and she kept saying it, and I kept thinking, I do not know what this woman is talking about. There's no richness in this. This is I'm devastated. This is emptiness, not richness. But I now completely understand, because it just, I don't know if I'll use the right words, expanded my heart and opened my heart and my mind too in ways that I didn't think was possible. I mean, even hearing you talk, it sounds like the relationships you had with them, they're still sort of a working thing.
Yeah,
they're
definitely.
They're not just something that just kind of gets closed and put away.
No, and I genuinely think that, because I have to say, you know, with a sibling, and again, I'm sure you guys have experienced this, it's like, are you married? Do you have a, you know, and I find, do you have any brothers or sisters? And the first time someone asked me that was weird, because I'd gone on some press trip. I was working for a fashion magazine and I was with all these glamorous people. I think David Gandy was there. It was kind of like someone had said, do you want to go to Montenegro with David Gandy? And I knew there'd be 30 other people.
Let me think about that.
But I thought, I'm only going to go because I can tell people I went to Montenegro with David Gandy. I won't mention others were there. It'll sound like we had a mini break. But no, what was interesting was a journalist, very well-meaning journalist, who was also on this press trip, just said, oh, are you? Is your sister working for a magazine? Oh. There's another woman with the surname Dean. And I said, no. And Jo Elvin, who's a friend of mine who used to edit Glamour, now it's You magazine, she knew the story. And she tried to change the subject. And he just said again, No, she looks just like you. Have you got a sister, though?
I think I'm sure.
And yeah. I didn't know what to say. Yeah. And do you know what I realised after that moment? I thought I denied her existence in that moment. And that's okay, because I panicked, but I never want to deny her existence, because I'm thrilled that she existed. Yeah. So next time, I made a real point. I thought, well, I denied her existence because it was socially awkward.
Do you not think it was because also you didn't want to make that guy feel really in an awkward position?
You've got
position.
It. I was protecting him from my grief. Mm. And I now think, but in protecting him from my grief, I denied my sister's existence. Yeah. And actually, that's more important that I don't do that. So from then on, and we all do that, don't we? We do it all the time. It's
I have straight up lied.
Yeah,
I've told people, like, oh, they live in America. Yeah. My parents live in America. They're fine. They're loving their retired years. Everything's great, because I just...
Have you?
Well, yeah.
Just because...
Just sometimes, like, it's not what I would do every time, but you definitely get the, and where do your parents live? Oh, they used to, and then people start the questions, and you just feel, like, just, I think what Venetia said is, I probably do it to make them feel more comfortable.
Because you want to tread around, and actually, when I did that, it was a wake up call, because I woke up and I couldn't stop thinking about how I felt like I'd sort of let her down. Mm. And I just thought, well, people are just going to have to accept this. And the next time I just said, I had a sister, but she died and I miss her every day. Then I think what I'm saying is, look, I'm okay. I can say this without breaking down, but I need to put this out there. And actually, do you know what's weird? Ever since I started doing that, I'll say that in a dinner party. There's a moment. I'm not going to lie. There's a moment. And then they say, oh, my God, I lost someone. Or if they don't say that, they'll say, oh, what happened? And then you have a real conversation with someone instead of talking about trivia.
But isn't that the whole point as well, that we don't talk about grief in the same way? Mm. So you might be sitting beside somebody in the pub or at a dinner party and get talking, and you both have this massive thing in common.
I know.
And yet, because one of you is holding back for whatever, whether it's fear of getting upset yourself, fear of upsetting somebody else, that you don't have the conversation, which you might go away feeling so much better after having.
And don't you think you do? I mean, I always, you know, it's smug grief club that we're in. But there is this thing. Always,
it is a club, though.
No, we're in the club.
It's a club.
Okay, I'm the treasurer, because I had three years.
I didn't want to be a member.
Don't want to boast, but 3 and 3 years, okay? So you two have got some catching up. Yeah. But it was interesting, because I was at a breakfast this morning at a press thing, and I was chatting to this lovely girl who was a presenter on Channel 4, and she was chatting, and it was a nice conversation, and then she suddenly said, my sister died. Mm. And do you know what? The conversation, obviously, from then on, she was my best friend. It was like, it's that bonding thing of, but I think we need to, and I know you two think this, but we just need to talk more about this. I find it so strange that there's so much embarrassment and awkwardness around it, and this idea that don't bring your grief in the room, don't talk about it. Since I wrote this book, I'm overwhelmed by, I was going to say, by the amount of men that have got in touch with me. It sounds like the underwear shots of me. In it. But just reaching out, saying, I don't know how to talk about this.
Yeah.
And I think it's terrible that no one tells you. No one has...
Do you think there's shame too, Emily? Like, I felt very ashamed.
Did
I felt
you?
Like embarrassed, you said, but like very much at the core, whatever that shame thing is that's deep down in that well of like from, I don't know, I just was so...
You're Irish, that's the whole thing as well.
Just so deeply embarrassed that I was sad.
Did your parents die close to each other?
Yeah, they did, a couple of years between them.
Do you think, because what I had was that sense of, I think I felt my friends had had a lot to bear, and that I felt embarrassed. I mean, I quote in my book that Brenda from Bristol, the snap election, oh, you're joking, another one! Yeah. I literally expected people to... I thought they were saying that behind closed doors. I think they were saying she's doing this for attention.
Honestly.
And I thought, oh, God, typical Emily.
But it's like that thing where, you know, you have this vision that you always ring one person or two people in your phone. Your name comes up on their phone. They're like, her again. I can't talk about that guy
she's
anymore.
Bring it up again.
It's all griefy, grief face again. Was the sort of, I referred to myself, I felt like, you know, they have that skull in the Renaissance painting to remind you of mortality. That was my brand, was, here she comes, the raven at the picnic. Mm. And that's hard, because I sort of felt, that wasn't who I was.
No.
But equally, it was tough. And I think I don't know how you two dealt with this, but it's only in retrospect that I can see I protected people from my grief. Mm. And I did a lot of my, what I call my kitchen floor parties, when I would just lie down. I would actually lie down on the floor, and I don't know what it was. It was about getting close to the ground. I mean, it was about sinking. It was about not existing, being as low as I could. And I would just lie there. And I would just, and I would hit, the phone would be going, the texts and the voicemails would be going, and I just think, you can't see this. This is too raw for you. And I have to present a version which is photoshopped a little bit. And now I don't care. And actually, the funny thing is, when I was writing the book, everyone said, it'll be so cathartic. Yeah, it's cathartic, but I think it would be really irresponsible of me to completely lie about that and say every day I sat down and there were snow white birds tweeting. It wasn't. It was tough. I had three ghosts I was living with for the year I wrote it. I love that I've written it and it was great. And I think I processed a lot of difficult stuff while I wrote it. But it was a difficult process. And during this process, I realised afterwards, what was weird, guys, was that I got really depressed afterwards. I'm sorry, that noise is my dog. Ray, sit down. It's not about you, OK? It is about you. The whole book's about you. But you know what was weird? After I'd written it, I had this really bad depression for about 3 months. And you know what I realised afterwards? It's because I was letting them go again. And I'd sort of almost for that period while I was writing it,
you're living with them again.
Do you know what I mean? I was telling these stories and they were with me, and I was, I only realised afterwards, I thought, that's, I'm re-losing them. And I went a bit underground and I didn't want to see people. I didn't have the perspective to work out why. And the comic, actually, Catherine Ryan, who's a friend of mine, and she kept texting, and I was, and she said, she sort of said, is everything all right? And I could tell she thought she'd upset me in some way. And I thought, I've got to be honest. And I told her. And because she's sort of cool and tough and acerbic, and I thought, I can't tell her this. But of course I did. And I just ended up going around to her. And she was amazing. And it brings you closer.
Of course it does. What do you think your relationship with writing is going to be like now? Because you've done this, right? And this is a big experience, a life-defining, like the life-defining. But now you've written a book. And this is incredible. Do you think you'll write another one?
I hope so. I mean, luckily people seem to be liking it. And when you sort of test the water a bit with the first book, don't you? And you think, well, is this all right? And luckily the response seems to be nice, which is great. And so I sort of feel I would really like to. I'm thinking about what the next book would be, and I am going to write another book. But I think, to be honest, this was always going to be the toughest thing to write because it's so personal. And I didn't make it easy for myself because the first book is a bit sort of, you know, wet your pants anywhere in terms of, oh, my God, what's everyone going to think? And to make the content so deeply personal. And it's exposing, isn't it? You're exposing your innards, your, you know, exes are reading
But also
this
in all the interviews and stuff, you have to keep talking about it again, which is great because, again, it keeps them alive. But sometimes you're just reliving the story again or reliving what happened again, which can be really upsetting.
Well, you know, although oddly doing this kind of interview I actually love, because to me it's, as long as I think being honest isn't exhausting, it's putting on a front that's exhausting. And weirdly it's more tiring thinking, oh, I've got to do this thing where I've got to be guarded or but just, you know, chatting to other people in a Smug Dead Club, that's my dream.
We're changing the name of the podcast.
Yeah, Smug Dead Club. Because I sort of think, actually, yeah, I understand that it's hard for some people who haven't experienced it to know what to say and do. And I get that. And I know why, you know, at the time, I remember getting cards from really well-meaning, lovely people, which read like they'd been written in 1820 by a governess, saying, on this sad occasion of your loss, would you say that to me? I mean, you know, and do you know what? There was a friend of mine, Mawena, and she just sent me an email when I got back, and I said, you know, when you send the messages to people, it's overwhelming, isn't it? Saying, but I sort of found that cathartic, telling people. I thought, while I'm telling people, it hasn't actually happened. Because it was odd for me that people said it's hard to tell people. And I thought, no, because I'm rewinding time.
Yeah.
I'm still with.
And I've got the control. I've got the control of being the newsbreaker rather than receiving the news. But I remember telling my friend Mawena, and she just said there was a series of expletives on this email. and that felt so honest and true. Mm. And to me, that was so comforting. And like I said, as well-meaning as these on this sad occasion of your sibling's demise,
but we've discussed that deeper.
Yeah. Like, I actually think Rob Delaney says so beautifully.
He's amazing, isn't he?
But one of the things he talked about was one of the people that worked with his family. I think that she helped look after the kids. And when she found out that his son Henry was quite sick, she just started wailing and fell to the floor and said, "Oh no." And he said, "Yes, finally, someone is having the kind of reaction that they should be having." And she wasn't worrying about being over the top. She was that empathy of, she didn't want his son to be sick and die. And the politeness is gone out of it.
Yeah.
And that it's empathy. It's ironic that in a way empathy gets built through the
because
then you sort of see the world in a different way. There can be a frustration in like almost like people hide behind things so they don't have to call, because empathy feels difficult. It feels uncomfortable.
Well, it's raw and it's tapping into an emotion that we don't use often in a sense, because we all do put on a front. You know, we have to sort of get by and do our jobs and everything. But it does mean that. I remember at my sister's funeral, and there was a girl who just sort of fell upon me and hugged me, and I found it very touching. Mm. And a friend of mine said afterwards, in the most well-meaning way, she said, "Well, I saw that, and I thought, this woman throwing herself at you with this grief." And I thought, no, I loved that. I loved that she cared, she was upset. Mm. And I think people want to protect you, but any sort of nicety and politeness, that was what I struggled with.
Yeah, it's the sort of awkward sort of, I always find in those situations I start talking about something else because I start feeling really awkward and I'll start talking about something completely random. You know,
what do you mean?
If somebody's sort of struggling with what to say about,
yes,
you feel,
you know, that, and I sort of feel that you can feel that they're just so out of their depth that you try and save the situation by going, "Oh my God, I went to this really great restaurant last night. It was da-da-da-da-da-da-da," and you change it completely just to
sort
of
empathy on your
salvage.
Behalf.
Yeah, but you do that.
But
I find that I do that
them,
so much more. Like in a lot of ways, because you're just trying
to
save
them. You're making it okay for them.
And I think so.
Women are naturally, you know, I think there is that thing of caretaking a bit and looking after everyone and making sure the atmosphere's okay. And I was always someone who did that anyway, because I grew up with sort of performers and that was what we did. My parents were just, you had to be on. You know, Frank always says about my childhood, he said, "You grew up in a green room, essentially." That's what we were always on. So we went to a dinner party once, and I always remember director said of this woman who was sitting there, someone had brought their partner in, this, she was quite a quiet, sort of introverted woman. And this director just turned around and said, "You have contributed nothing to this evening." And it was so interesting that that in my dynamic was normal. That it's like, you've got to be on, bring something to the table. So I think with the grief thing, I still had that sense of, I've still got to perform. I've still got to bring something.
Whereas especially, I think, if you're somebody who has sort of a big personality or whatever, people do expect
you to be on.
You to sort of go back to sort of the way you are.
Yeah, they do, and quickly. You know, and you said, someone once said to me, "Oh, you're crying, what's wrong?" And I said, I never forgot this, I said, "It will always be about my sister." It will always be. Because nothing, you know, that, what happens, in a way, it is, but it's amazing because every time that happens, I remember her and I think I'll never forget her and I'll never forget my parents. That's why you've got to feel and talk about it, because that's honouring, that's her legacy. It's honouring them.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.